I don't regret it either, even though I wish we could go back and get me home on time. My parents don't want me seeing you anymore.
I write. We'll just have to convince them to change their minds. By the way, for what it's worth, you showed me something, Ultraviolet. There is such a thing as a perfect day. The next morning, I'm at Violet's, ringing the bell. Mrs. Markey answers, but instead of letting me in, she stands in the doorway, the door pulled close around her. She smiles apologetically, "I'm sorry, Theodore." She shakes her head, and that one gesture says it all. "I'm sorry that you will never be allowed near our daughter again, because you are different and strange and a person who cannot be trusted." I can hear Mr. Markey from inside.
"Is that him?"
She doesn't answer. Instead, her eyes run over my face, as if she's been told to check for bruises or maybe something deeper and even more broken. It's a kind gesture, but something about it makes me feel like I'm not really there.
"Are you all right?"
"Sure, I'm fine. Nothing to see here. I'd be even better, though, if I could talk to you and explain and say I'm sorry and see Violet. Just for a couple minutes, nothing more. Maybe if I could just come in..."
"All I need is the chance to sit down with them and talk and tell them it's not as bad as they think, that it'll never happen again, and they weren't wrong to trust me."
Over his wife's shoulder, Mr. Markey frowns at me.
"You need to go."
Just like that, they shut the door, and I am on the step, locked out and alone. At home, I type in eleanorandviolet.com and get a message. Server not found. I type it again and again, but each time it's the same thing. She's gone. 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 On Facebook, I write, "Are you there?" Violet:
"I'm here."
Me:
"I came to see you."
Violet:
"I know. They're so mad at me."
Me: "I told you I break things."
Violet: "This wasn't you, this was us. But it's my fault, I wasn't thinking."
Me: "I'm lying here wishing I could count us backward to yesterday morning. I want the planets to align again."
Violet: "Just give them time."
I write, "That's the only thing I don't have." And then I erase it. Finch: How to Survive Quicksand. That night, I move into my walk-in closet, which is warm and cozy like a cave. I push my hanging clothes to one corner and lay the comforter from my bed on the floor. I set the jug of Mudlavia healing water at the foot and prop Violet's picture against the wall, a shot of her at the blue flash, along with the license plate I took from the scene of the accident. Then I turn off the light. I balance my laptop on my knees and stick a cigarette in my mouth, unlit, because the air's too close in here as it is. This is Finch Survival Boot Camp. I've been here before and know the drill like the back of my too large hand. I will stay in here as long as I need to. As long as it takes. The Mythbusters say there is no way to drown in quicksand, but tell that to the young mother who went to Antigua for her father's wedding, to wife number two, and was sucked into the beach as she watched the sunset. Or the teenage boys who were swallowed whole by a man-made quicksand pit on the property of an Illinois businessman. Apparently, to survive quicksand, you should stay perfectly still, It's only when you panic that you pull yourself under and sink. So maybe if I stay still and follow the 8 steps to surviving quicksand, I'll get through this. 1. Avoid quicksand. Okay, too late, moving on. 2. Bring a large stick when going into quicksand territory. The theory here is that you can use the stick to test the ground in front of you and even pull yourself out of it if you sink. The problem with this theory is that you don't always know when you're entering quicksand territory, not until it's too late. But I like the idea of preparedness. I figure I've just left this step and have gone on to 3. Drop everything if you find yourself in quicksand. If you're weighed down by something heavy, you're apt to get pulled to the bottom faster. You need to shed your shoes and anything you're carrying. It's always best to do this when you know ahead of time that you're going to encounter quicksand, scene number 2. So, essentially, if you're going anywhere that might even possibly have quicksand, go naked. My removal to the closet is part of the dropping everything. 4. Relax. This goes back to the stay perfectly still so you don't sink adage. Additional fact, if you relax, your body's buoyancy will cause you to float. In other words, it's time to be calm and let the Jovian-Plutonian gravitational effect take over. 5. Breathe deeply. This goes hand in hand with number 4. The trick, apparently, is to keep as much air in your lungs as possible. The more you breathe, the more you float. 6. Get on your back. If you start sinking, you simply fall backward and spread yourself out as far as you can as you try to pull your legs free. Once you're unrooted, you can inch yourself to solid ground and safety. 7. Take your time. Wild movements only hurt your cause, so move slowly and carefully until you're free again. 8. Take frequent breaks. Climbing out of quicksand can be a long process, so be sure to take breaks when you feel your breath running out or your body beginning to tire. Keep your head high so that you buy yourself more time.
Violet, the week after. I go back to school, expecting everyone to know. I walk through the halls and stand at my locker and sit in class and wait for my teachers and classmates to give me a knowing look or say, "Someone's not a virgin anymore." It's actually kind of disappointing when they don't. The only one who figures it out is Brenda. We sit in the cafeteria, picking up the burritos some Indiana kitchen worker has attempted to make, and she asks what I did over the weekend. My mouth is full of burrito, and I am trying to decide whether to swallow it or spit it out, which means I don't answer right away. She says, "Oh my God, you slept with him!" Lara and the 3 Briannas stop eating. 15 or 20 heads turn in our direction because Brenda has a really loud voice when she wants to. You know he'll never say a word to anyone. I mean, he's a gentleman, just in case you were wondering. She pops the tab on her soda and drinks half of it down. "Okay, I've been wondering a little. After all, it's my first time, but not his. He's Finch, and I trust him, but you just never know. Guys do talk. And even though the day of wasn't slutty, I feel a little slutty, but also kind of grown up." On our way out of the cafeteria, mostly to change the subject, I tell Brenda about Germ and ask if she'd like to be a part of it. Her eyes go narrow, like she's trying to see if I'm joking or not. "I'm serious. There's a lot left to figure out, but I know I want Germ to be original. Bren throws back her head and laughs kind of diabolically. Okay, she says, catching her breath. I'm in. When I see Finch in U.S. geography, he looks tired, like he hasn't slept at all. I sit beside him, across the room from Amanda, Romer, and Ryan, and afterward he pulls me under the stairwell and kisses me like he's afraid I might disappear. There's something forbidden about the whole thing that makes the electric currents burn stronger, and I want school to be over forever so we don't have to come here at all. I tell myself that we can just take off in Little Bastard and head west or east, north or south, till we've left Indiana far behind. We'll wander the country and then the world, just Theodore Finch and me. But for now, for the rest of the week, we see each other only at school, kissing under stairwells or in dark corners. In the afternoons, we go our separate ways. At night, we talk online. Finch, any change? Me, if you mean my parents, no. Finch, what are the odds of them forgiving and forgetting? The truth is, the odds aren't very good. But I don't want to say this because he's worried enough, and ever since that night, there's something pulled in about him, as if he's standing behind a curtain. Me. They just need time. Finch. I hate to be all Romeo and Juliet about this, but I want to see you alone. As in when we're not surrounded by the entire population of Bartlett High. Me. If you came over here and I sneaked out or sneaked you in, they really would lock me in the house forever. We go back and forth for the next hour thinking up wild scenarios for seeing each other, including a faked alien abduction, triggering the citywide tornado alarm, and digging an underground tunnel that would stretch from his side of town to mine. It's 1 a.m. when I tell him I have to get some sleep, but I end up lying in bed, eyes open. My brain is awake and racing, the way it used to be before last spring. I turn on my light and sketch out ideas for Germ. Ask a parent. Book playlists. Monthly soundtracks. Lists of places where girls like me can get involved. One of the things I want to create is a wander section, where readers can send in pictures or videos of their favorite grand, small, bizarre, poetic, nothing ordinary sights. I email Brenda and send Finch a note in case he's still awake. And then, even though it's jumping the gun a little, I write to Jordan Grippenwalt, Shelby Paget, Ashley Dunstan, the three Briannas, and reporter Leticia Lopez, inviting them to contribute. Also Brenda's friend Lara, and other girls I know who are good writers or artists or have something original to say. Dear Chameli, Brittany, Rebecca, Emily, Saida, Priscilla, Annalise. Eleanor and I were eleanorandviolet.com. But as far as I'm concerned, the more voices here, the better. I think about asking Amanda. I write her a letter and leave it in my drafts folder. When I get up the next morning, I delete it. On Saturday, I eat breakfast with my parents, and then I tell them I'm going to ride my bike over to Amanda's house. They don't question me about why I want to hang out with this person I barely like, or what we're planning to do, or when I'll be back. For some reason, they trust Amanda Monk. I ride past her house and continue across town to Finch's, and the whole thing is so easy, even though I have this weird stitch in my chest because I just lied to my parents. When I get there, Finch makes me crawl up the fire escape and climb in the window so I don't run into his mom or sisters. Do you think they saw? I brush the dust off my jeans.
I doubt it. They're not even home.
He laughs when I pinch his arm, and then his hands are on my face and he's kissing me, which makes the stitch disappear. Because his bed is stacked with clothes and books, he drags a comforter out of his closet and we lie on the floor, the blanket wrapped around us. Under the covers, we get naked and heated. And afterward, we talk like children, the blanket up over our heads. We lie there whispering, as if someone might hear us. And for the first time, I tell him about Germ. I think this could actually be something. And it's because of you, I say. When I met you, I was finished with all this. I didn't think it mattered.
One, you worry about everything being filler, but the words you write will still be here when you're gone. And two, you were finished with a lot of things, but you would have come around whether you met me or not.
For some reason, I don't like the way this sounds, as if a universe could exist in which I wouldn't know Finch. But then, we're under the blanket again discussing all the places in the world we want to wander, which somehow turns into all the places in the world we want to do it.
We'll take this show on the road,
says Finch, tracing lazy circles on my shoulder, down my arm, over to my hip.
We'll wander every state, and after we check them off, we'll go across the ocean and start wandering there. It will be a wander-a-thon.
Wander-mania.
Wanderama.
Without consulting the computer, we list the places we might go, taking turns. And then, for some reason, I have that feeling again, as if he's stepped behind a curtain. And then the stitch returns, and I can't help thinking of all I'm doing to be here. Sneaking around behind my parents' backs for one, lying to them for another. At some point I say, I should probably go. He kisses me.
Or you could stay a little longer.
So I do. Violet. Spring break. Noon. NYU campus, New York, New York. My mom says,
Your father and I are glad to have this time with you, honey. It's good for all of us to get away.
She means away from home, but I think more than that, she means away from Finch. I'm carrying our wandering notebook so that I can make notes on the buildings and the history and anything interesting that I might want to share with him. My parents are discussing how I can apply for spring admission next year and transfer from whatever school I choose for fall. I'm more worried about why Finch hasn't answered my last three texts. I wonder if this is the way it will be next year, if I come to New York or wherever I go. Me trying to concentrate on college, on life, when all I'm doing is thinking about him. I wonder if he'll come with me. Or if our built-in ending is high school. My mom says,
It'll be here before we know it, and I'm not ready. I don't think I'll ever be ready.
Don't start crying, Mom. You promised. We've still got lots of time to go, and we don't know where I'm going to end up.
My dad says, Just an excuse to come see her and spend time in the city.
But his eyes go damp, too. Even though they don't say it, I can feel all the expectation and weight surrounding us. It comes from the fact that they didn't get to do this with their older daughter. They never got to take her to college and wish her a good freshman year. Be safe, come home and see us. Don't forget, we're always a phone call away. It's just one more moment they were cheated of, and one more I have to make up for because I'm all that's left. Before the three of us lose it right there in the middle of campus, I say, Dad, what can you tell us about the history of NYU? I have my own room at the hotel. It is narrow, with two windows, a dresser, and a giant TV cabinet that looks as if it might fall on you and crush you while you sleep. The windows are closed tight, but I can still hear the noises of the city, which are so different from the ones I hear in Bartlett. Sirens, yelling, music, garbage trucks rattling up and down.
So, do you have a special boy back home?
My mom's agent asked over dinner. No one in particular, I answered her, and my parents exchanged a look of relief and conviction that, yes, they did the right thing by chasing Finch away. The only light in the room is from my laptop. I skim through our notebook, thick with words, and then through our Facebook messages. So many now. And then I write a new one, quoting Virginia Woolf. Let us wander, whirling to the gilt chairs. Are we not acceptable, Moon? Are we not lovely sitting together here?
Finch. Day 64 of The Awake. On the last Sunday of spring break, it snows again, and for an hour or so, everything is white. We spend the morning with Mom. I help Decca in the yard, building a half-snow, half-mud man, and then we walk 6 blocks to the hill behind my grade school and go sledding. We race each other, and Decca wins every time because it makes her happy. On the way home, she says, "You better not have let me win." "Never." I throw an arm around her shoulders, and she doesn't pull away. "I don't want to go to Dad's," she says. "Me neither. But you know deep down it means a lot to him, even though he doesn't show it." This is something my mother has said to me more than once. I don't know that I believe it, but there's a chance Decca might. As tough as she wants to believe in something. In the afternoon, we head over to my father's house, where we sit inside, scattered around the living room, hockey playing on yet another giant flat screen that has been implanted into the wall. Dad is alternately shouting at the television and listening to Kate talk about Colorado. Josh Raymond sits at my father's elbow, staring at the game, and chewing each mouthful 45 times. I know, because I'm so bored, I start counting. At some point, I get up and go to the bathroom, mainly just to clear my head and text Violet, who comes home today. I sit waiting for her to text me back, flipping the faucets on and off. I wash my hands, wash my face, rummage through the cabinets. I am starting in on the shower rack when my phone buzzes. "Home! Should I sneak over?" I write, "Not yet. Am currently in hell, but will leave as soon as possible." We go back and forth for a little while, and then I set off down the hallway, toward the noise and the people. I pass Josh Raymond's room, and the door is ajar, and he's inside. I knock, and he squeaks, "Come in!" I go into what must be the largest room for a 7-year-old on the planet. The thing is so cavernous, I wonder if he needs a map. And it's filled with every toy you can imagine, most requiring batteries. I say, "This is quite a room you have, Josh Raymond." I am trying not to let it bother me because jealousy is a mean, unpleasant feeling that only eats you from the inside. And I do not need to stand here, an almost 18-year-old with a really sexy girlfriend, even if she's not allowed to see me anymore, and worry about the fact that my stepbrother seems to own thousands of Legos. "It's okay." He is sorting through a chest that contains, believe it or not, more toys, when I see them. two old-fashioned wooden stick horses, one black, one gray, that sit forgotten in a corner. These are my stick horses, the same ones I used to ride for hours when I was younger than Josh Raymond, pretending I was Clint Eastwood from one of the old movies my dad used to watch on our small, non-flat-screen TV. The one, incidentally, we still have and use. "Those are pretty cool horses," I say. Their names are Midnight and Scout. He swivels his head around, blinks twice, and says, "They're okay."
"What are their names?"
"They don't have names." I suddenly want to take the stick horses and march into the living room and whack my father over the head with them. Then I want to take them home with me. I'll pay attention to them every day. I'll ride them all over town.
"Where'd you get them?" I ask.
"My dad got them for me."
I want to say, "Not your dad, my dad. Let's just get this straight right now. You already have a dad somewhere else, and even though mine isn't all that great, he's the only one I've got." But then I look at this kid, at the thin face and the thin neck and the scrawny shoulders, and he's 7 and small for his age, and I remember what that was like. And I also remember what it was like growing up with my father. I say, "You know, I had a couple of horses once, not as cool as these here, but they were still pretty tough. I named them Midnight and Scout."
"Midnight and Scout?" He eyes the horses. "Those are good names."
"If you want, you can have them."
"Really?"
He is looking up at me with owl eyes.
"Sure."
Josh Raymond finds the toy he's looking for, some sort of robo-car, and as we walk out the door, he takes my hand. Back in the living room, my father smiles his camera-ready Sports Center smile and nods at me like we're buddies.
"You should bring your girlfriend over here."
He says this like nothing ever happened, and he and I are the best of friends.
"That's okay. She's busy on Sundays." I can imagine the conversation between my father and Mr. Markey.
"Your delinquent son has my daughter. At this moment, she is probably lying in a ditch, thanks to him." "What did you think would happen? Damn right he's a delinquent and a criminal and an emotional wreck and a major disappointment weirdo fuck-up. Be grateful for your daughter, sir, because trust me, you would not want my son. No one does."
I can see Dad searching for something to say.
"Well, any day is fine, isn't it, Rosemary? You just bring her by whenever you can."
He's in one of his very best moods, and Rosemary nods and beams. He slaps his hand against the chair arm.
"Bring her over here, and we'll put some steaks on the grill and something with beans and twigs on it for you."
I am attempting not to explode all over the room. I am trying to keep myself very small and very contained. I am counting as fast as I can. Thankfully, the game comes back on and he's distracted. I sit another few minutes, and then I thank Rosemary for the meal, ask Kate if she can take Decca back to Mom's, and tell everyone else I'll see them at home. I walk across town to my house, climb inside Little Bastard, and drive. No map, no purpose. I drive for what feels like hours, passing fields of white. I head north, and then west, and then south, and then east, the car pushing 90. By sunset, I'm on my way back to Bartlett, cutting through the heart of Indianapolis, smoking my 4th American Spirit cigarette in a row. I drive too fast, but it doesn't feel fast enough. I certainly hate little bastard for slowing me down when I need to go, go, go. The nicotine scrapes at my throat, which is already raw, and I feel like throwing up, so I pull over onto the shoulder and walk around. I bend over, hands on my knees. I wait. When I don't get sick, I look at the road stretched out ahead and start to run. I run like hell, leaving little bastard behind. I run so hard and fast I feel like my lungs will explode, and then I go harder and faster. I'm daring my lungs and my legs to give out on me. I can't remember if I locked the car, and God, I hate my mind when it does that, because now I can only think about the car door and that lock. And so I run harder. I don't remember where my jacket is, or if I even had one. It will be all right. I will be all right. It won't fall apart. It will be all right. It will be okay. I'm okay. 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 Suddenly I'm surrounded by farms again. At some point I pass a series of commercial greenhouses and nurseries. They won't be open on Sunday, but I run up the drive of one that looks like a real mom-and-pop organization. A two-story white farmhouse sits on the back of the property. The driveway is crowded with trucks and cars, and I can hear the laughter from inside. I wonder what would happen if I just walked in and sat down and made myself at home. I go up to the front door and knock. I am breathing hard, and I should have waited to knock so I could catch my breath, but no, I think. I'm in too much of a hurry. I knock again, louder this time. A woman with white hair and the soft, round face of a dumpling answers, still laughing from the conversation she left. She squints at me through the screen, and then opens it because we're in the country, and this is Indiana, and there is nothing to fear from our neighbors. It's one of the things I like about living here, and I want to hug her for the warm but confused smile she wears as she tries to figure out if she's seen me before. "Hello there," I say.
"Hello,"
she says. I can imagine what I must look like, red face, no coat, sweating and panting and gasping for air. I compose myself as fast as I can. "I'm sorry to disturb you, but I'm on my way home and I just happened to pass your nursery. I know you're closed and you have company, but I wonder if I could pick out a few flowers for my girlfriend. It's kind of an emergency." Her face wrinkles with concern.
"An emergency? Oh, dear."
"Maybe that's a strong word, and I'm sorry to alarm you, but winter is here, and I don't know where I'll be by spring. And she's named for a flower, and her father hates me, and I want her to know that I'm thinking of her, and that this isn't a season of death, but one for living." A man walks up behind her, napkin still tucked into his shirt.
"There you are," he says to the woman. "I wondered where you'd gone off to."
He nods at me. She says,
"This young man is having an emergency."
I explain myself all over again to him. She looks at him, and he looks at me, and then he calls to someone inside, telling them to stir the cider. And out he comes, napkin blowing a little in the cold wind, and I walk beside him, hands in my pockets, as we go to the nursery door and he pulls a janitor's keychain off his belt. I am talking a mile a minute, thanking him and telling him I'll pay him double, and even offering to send a picture of Violet with the flowers, maybe violets, once I give them to her. He lays a hand on my shoulder and says,
"You don't worry about that, son. I want you to take what you need."
Inside, I breathe in the sweet, living scent of the flowers.
I want to stay in here, where it's warm and bright, surrounded by things that are living and not dead. I want to move in with this good-hearted couple and have them call me son. And Violet can live here too because there's room enough for both of us. He helps me choose the brightest blooms, not just violets, but daisies and roses and lilies and others I can't remember the names of. Then he and his wife, whose name is Margaret Ann, wrap them in a refrigerated shipping bucket, which will keep the flowers hydrated. I try to pay them, but they wave my money away, and I promise to bring the bucket back as soon as I can. By the time we're done, their guests have gathered outside to see the boy who must have flowers to give to the girl he loves. The man, whose name is Henry, drives me back to my car. For some reason, I expect it to take hours, but it only takes a few minutes to reach it. As we circle back around to the other side of the road, where little bastard sits looking patient and abandoned, he says, 6 miles. Son, you ran all that way?
Yes, sir, I guess I did. I'm sorry to pull you away from dinner.
That's no worry, young man, no worry at all. Is something wrong with your car?
No, sir, it just didn't go fast enough.
He nods as if this makes all the sense in the world, which it probably doesn't, and says, You tell that girl of yours hello from us. But you drive back home, you hear?
It's after 11 when I reach her house, and I sit in Little Bastard for a while, the windows rolled down, the engine off, smoking my last cigarette because now that I'm here I don't want to disturb her. The windows of the house are lit up, and I know she is in there with her parents, who love her but hate me, and I don't want to intrude. But then she texts me, as if she knows where I am, and says, I'm glad to be back. When will I see you?
I text her, Come outside. She is there in a minute, wearing monkey pajamas and Freud slippers, and a long purple robe, her hair pulled into a ponytail. I come up the walk carrying the refrigerated shipping bucket, and she says, Finch, what on earth? Why do you smell like smoke? She looks behind her, afraid they might see. The night air is freezing, and a few flakes start to fall again. But I feel warm. She says, You're shivering. Am I? I don't notice because I can't feel anything.
How long have you been out here?
I don't know. And suddenly I can't remember.
It snowed today. It's snowing again.
Her eyes are red. She looks like she's been crying. And this might be because she really hates winter, or, more likely, because we're coming up on the anniversary of the accident. I hold out the bucket and say, Which is why I wanted you to have these.
What is it?
Open and see. She sets down the bucket and undoes the latch. For a few seconds, all she does is breathe in the scent of the flowers. And then she turns to me and, without a word, kisses me. When she pulls away, she says,
No more winter at all. Finch, you brought me spring.
For a long time I sit in the car outside my house, afraid to break the spell. In here, the air is close and Violet is close. I'm wrapped up in the day. I love the way her eyes spark when we're talking, or when she's telling me something she wants me to know. The way she mouths the words to herself when she's reading and concentrating. The way she looks at me as if there's only me. As if she can see past the flesh and bone and bullshit, right into the me that's there. The one I don't even see myself.
Finch. Days 65 and 66. At school, I catch myself staring out the window and I think, how long was I doing that? I look around to see if anybody noticed, half expecting them to be staring at me. But no one is looking. This happens in every period. Even gym. In English, I open my book because the teacher is reading, and everyone else is reading along. Even though I hear the words, I forget them as soon as they're said. I hear fragments of things, but nothing whole. Relax. Breathe deeply. Count. After class, I head for the bell tower, not caring who sees me. The door to the stairs opens easily, and I wonder if Violet was here. Once I am up and out in the fresh air, I open the book again. I read the same passage over and over, thinking maybe if I just get away by myself, I'll be able to focus better. But the second I'm done with one line and move on to the next, I've forgotten the one that came before. At lunch, I sit with Charlie, surrounded by people, but alone. They are talking to me and around me, but I can't hear them. I pretend to be interested in one of my books, but the words dance on the page, and so I tell my face to smile so that no one will see, and I smile and nod, and I do a pretty good job of it, until Charlie says, "Man, what is wrong with you? You are seriously bringing me down." In U.S. geography, Mr. Black stands at the board and reminds us once again that just because we're seniors and this is our last semester, we do not need to slack off. As he talks, I write, but the same thing happens as when I was trying to read. The words are there one minute, and the next they're gone. Violet sits beside me, and I catch her glancing at my paper, so I cover it up with my hand. It's hard to describe, but I imagine the way I am at this moment is a lot like getting sucked into a vortex. Everything dark and churning, but slow churning instead of fast, and this great weight pulling you down like it's attached to your feet, even if you can't see it. I think this is what it must feel like to be trapped in quicksand. Part of the writing is taking stock of everything in my life, like I'm running down a checklist. Amazing girlfriend. Check. Decent friends. Check. Roof over my head. Check. Food in my mouth. Check. I will never be short and probably not bald if my dad and grandfathers are any indication. On my good days, I can outthink most people. I'm decent on the guitar and I have a better than average voice. I can write songs, ones that will change the world. Everything seems to be in working order, but I go over the list again and again in case I'm forgetting something, making myself think beyond the big things in case there's something hiding out behind the smaller details. On the big side, my family could be better, but I'm not the only kid who feels that way. At least they haven't thrown me out on the street. School's okay. I could study more, but I don't really need to. The future is uncertain, but that can be a good thing. On the smaller side, I like my eyes but hate my nose, but I don't think my nose is what's making me feel this way. My teeth are good. In general, I like my mouth, especially when it's attached to Violet's. My feet are too big, but at least they're not too small. Otherwise, I would be falling over all the time. I like my guitar and my bed, and my books, especially the cut-up ones. I think through everything, but in the end, the weight is heavier, as if it's moving up the rest of my body and sucking me down. The bell rings and I jump, which causes everyone to laugh, except Violet, who is watching me carefully. I'm scheduled to see Embryo now, and I'm afraid he'll notice something's up. I walk Violet to class and hold her hand, and kiss her, and give her the best smile I can find so that she won't watch me that way. And then, because her class is on the opposite side of school from the counseling office, and I'm not exactly running to get there, I show up 5 minutes late to my appointment. Embryo wants to know what's wrong and why I look like this, and does it have something to do with turning 18 soon? It's not that, I tell him. After all, who wouldn't want to be 18? Just ask my mom, who would give anything not to be 41.
Then what is it? What's going on with you, Finch?
I need to give him something, so I tell him it's my dad, which isn't exactly a lie, more of a half-truth, because it's only one part of a much bigger picture. He doesn't want to be my dad, I say. And Embryo listens so seriously and closely, his thick arms crossed over his thick chest, that I feel bad. So I tell him some more truth. He wasn't happy with the family he had, so he decided to trade us in for a new one he liked better. And he does like this one better. His new wife is pleasant and always smiling, and his new son, who may or may not actually be related to him, is small and easy and doesn't take up much space. Hell, I like them better myself. I think I've said too much, but instead of telling me to man up and walk it off, Embryo says, "I thought your father died in a hunting accident." For a second, I can't remember what he's talking about. Then, too late, I start nodding. "That's right, he did. I meant before he died." He is frowning at me, but instead of calling me a liar, he says, "I'm sorry you've had to deal with this in your life." I want to bawl, but I tell myself, disguise the pain, don't call attention. Don't be noticed. So with every last ounce of energy, energy that will cost me a week, maybe more, I say, "He does the best he can. I mean, he did, when he was alive. The best sucks, but at the end of the day, it's got more to do with him than me. And I mean, let's face it, who couldn't love me?" As I sit across from him, telling my face to smile, my mind recites the suicide note of Vladimir Mayakovsky, poet of the Russian Revolution, who shot himself at the age of 36. "My beloved boat is broken on the rocks of daily life. I've paid my debts, and no longer need to count pains I've suffered at the hands of others. The misfortunes and the insults. Good luck to those who remain." And suddenly Embryo is hunched over his desk, staring at me, with what could only be called alarm. Which means I must have said this out loud, without meaning to. His voice takes on the slow, deliberate tone of a man talking someone off a ledge.
"Were you in the bell tower again today?"
"Jesus, do you guys have, like, security cameras up there?"
"Answer me."
"Yes, sir, but I was reading, or trying to. I needed to clear my mind, and I couldn't do it down below with all the noise."
"Finch, I hope you know I'm your friend, and that means I want to help you. But this is also a legal matter,
and I have an obligation.
I'm fine. Believe me, if I decide to kill myself, you'll be the first to know. I'll save you a front row seat, or at least wait till you've got more money for the lawsuit.
Note to self, suicide is not a laughing matter, particularly for authority figures who are in any way responsible for you. I rein myself in. Sorry, bad taste, but I'm fine. Really.
What do you know about bipolar disorder?
I almost say, what do you know about it? But I make myself breathe and smile.
Is that the Jekyll Hyde thing?
My voice sounds flat and even. Maybe a little bored, even though my mind and body are on alert.
Some people call it manic depression. It's a brain disorder that causes extreme shifts in mood and energy. It runs in families, but it can be treated.
I continue to breathe, even if I'm not smiling anymore. But here's what is happening. My brain and my heart are pounding out different rhythms. My hands are turning cold and the back of my neck is turning hot. My throat has gone completely dry. The thing I know about bipolar disorder is that it's a label, one you give crazy people. I know this because I've taken junior year psychology, and I've seen movies, and I've watched my father in action for almost 18 years, even though you could never slap a label on him because he would kill you. Labels like bipolar say, "This is why you are the way you are. This is who you are." They explain people away as illnesses. Embryo is talking about symptoms and hypomania and psychotic episodes when the bell rings. I stand more abruptly than I mean to, which sends my chair clattering into the wall and onto the floor. If I'm suspended above the room, looking down, I can see how this would be mistaken for a violent act, especially as large as I am. Before I can tell him it was an accident, he is on his feet. I hold up my hands in a gesture of surrender, and then hold out my hand, an olive branch. It takes him a good minute or two, but he shakes it. Instead of letting go, he jerks my arm forward so we are almost nose to nose, or, given our height difference, nose to chin, and says, "You are not alone." Before I can tell him, actually I am, which is part of the problem. We are all alone, trapped in these bodies and our own minds, and whatever company we have in this life is only fleeting and superficial. He tightens his grip, until I worry my arm will snap off. And we are not done discussing this. The next morning after gym, Romer walks by and says, "Freak," under his breath. There are still a lot of guys milling around, but I don't care. To be more accurate, I don't think. It just happens. In a flash, I have him up against the locker, my hands around his throat, and I'm choking him until he turns purple. Charlie is behind me, trying to pull me off, and then Capel is there with his bat. I keep going because now I'm fascinated by the way Romer's veins are throbbing, and the way his head looks like a light bulb, all lit up and too bright. It takes four of them to get me off him because my fist is like iron. I'm thinking, "You put me here. You did this. It's your fault, your fault, your fault." Romer drops to the floor, and as I'm being dragged away, I lock eyes with him and say, "You will never call me that again."
Violet, March 10th. My phone buzzes after third period, and it's Finch. He He tells me he's waiting outside near the river. He wants to drive down south to Evansville to see the nest houses, which are these huts woven out of saplings that were created by an Indiana artist. They're literally like birds' nests for humans, with windows and doors. Finch wants to see if there's anything left of them. While we're down there, we can cross the Kentucky border and take pictures of ourselves, 1 foot in Kentucky, 1 in Indiana. I say, doesn't the Ohio River run the entire border? So we'd have to stand on a bridge. But he keeps right on like he doesn't hear me.
As a matter of fact, we should do this with Illinois, Michigan, and Ohio.
Why aren't you on your way to class? I'm wearing one of his flowers in my hair.
I got expelled. Just come out here.
Expelled?
Let's go. I'm wasting gas and daylight.
It's 4 hours to Evansville, Finch. By the time we get there, it'll be dark.
Not if we leave now. Come on. Come on. Get out here. We can sleep there.
He is talking too fast, as if everything depends on us looking at nest houses. When I ask him what happened, he just says he'll tell me later, but he needs to go now, as soon as possible. It's a Tuesday in winter. We're not sleeping in a nest house. We can go Saturday. If you wait for me after school, we can go somewhere a little closer than the Indiana-Kentucky border.
You know what? Why don't we just forget it? Why don't I go by myself? I think I'd rather go alone anyway.
Through the phone, his voice sounds hollow. And then he hangs up on me. I'm still staring at the phone when Ryan walks past with Suze Haynes, hand in hand.
Everything okay?
He says. Everything's fine, I answer, wondering what on earth just happened.
Finch. Days 66 and 67. The nest houses aren't there. It's dark by the time I stop in downtown New Harmony, with its brightly painted buildings, and ask everyone I can find about where the houses have gone. Most people haven't heard of them, but one old man tells me, "Sorry you came all this way. I'm afraid they've been ate up by weather and the elements." Just like all of us. The nest houses have reached their life expectancy. I think of the mud nest we made for the Cardinal all those years ago, and wonder if it's still there. I imagine his little bones and his little grave, and it is the saddest thought in the world. At home, everyone is asleep. I go upstairs and for a long time I look at myself in the bathroom mirror, and I actually disappear before my eyes. I am disappearing. Maybe I'm already gone. Instead of feeling panicked, I am fascinated, as if I'm a monkey in a lab. What makes the monkey turn invisible? And if you can't see him, can you still touch him if you wave your hand around in the place where he used to be? I lay my hand on my chest, over my heart, and I can feel the flesh and bone and the hard, erratic beating of the organ that is keeping me alive. I walk into my closet and shut the door. Inside, I try not to take up too much space or make any noise because if I do, I may wake up the darkness. And I want the darkness to sleep. I'm careful when I breathe, so as not to breathe too loudly. If I breathe too loudly, there's no telling what the darkness will do to me, or to Violet, or to anyone I love. The next morning I check messages on our home voicemail, the landline my mom and sisters and I share. There is one from Embryo for my mother, left yesterday afternoon. "Mrs. Finch, this is Robert Embry from Bartlett High. As you know, I've been counseling your son. I need to talk to you about Theodore. I'm afraid it's extremely important.